Here's that's here, we'll start the meeting. No, you can't leave, Representative House, it's...
I'm carrying them.
We have the truly concerned because we're going today to hear from the Department of Finance and the debt management presentation. So they're going to tell us how much money we can spend without getting further in debt. So Commissioner Engeson and Mr. Sawson. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. I'm Peggy Engeson, Commissioner of Finance, and I'm just actually here to make a couple of introductory remarks. I know it was a couple of weeks ago that we presented the governor's capital budget recommendations, and there were a number of questions from committee members about our debt management policies and our guidelines and kind of where we're at currently against those guidelines currently and with the governor's recommendations. And I appreciate your scheduling this hearing to have Mr. Salson, our assistant commissioner for debt and treasury management, present to you some of the background here. The debt management guidelines are an important part of our state fiscal picture here, and I'm glad that the committee is interested in learning a little bit more about the background of these.
Commissioner, if you could just give us, before we get into the formal presentation, questions that committee members might have with how much additional debt services would be required to service general obligation bonds of $580 million or $680 million. We always go through this, I think, on a regular basis. In fact, last year I think we had some extended discussion about I think your predecessor in this job at one point said that we were going to allow $15 million of additional debt service. And then the question became, well, additional $15 million in debt service will service what amount of GO bonds? So maybe I'm jumping ahead and getting into Mr. Sawson's presentation, but can you just, as I said, is this something we're going to cover, or as I said, we go through this regular gymnastics process of how much debt service and how much in general obligation bonding we're doing? So,
Mr. Chairman, I think that Mr. Salson will be able to answer those questions, but generally there's a lot of variables that are in place. And maybe just to kind of explain a couple of the variables. One is that we have a forecast the November forecast is kind of the budget that we're operating under right now, and that has debt service, assuming that a bonding bill this session would be $530 million in general fund-supported general obligation bonds as part of that. And so that's kind of the baseline that is out there right now. And so that's the assumption that's built into our forecast in November. As you know, the governor made recommendations for a higher dollar amount. A couple of things that are going on is that we're in the process of updating the November forecast, and that'll be released on February 27th. And then also, at that point in time, will be kind of a complete, after that comes out, the governor's supplemental budget recommendations will kind of reconcile against that forecast. So the governor is recommending bonding that requires some added debt service over and above the budget that we have. And Mr. Salson has some of the specifics with the dollars, but maybe the other thing that I would mention is that we frequently talk about the debt service that's needed for a certain size bonding bill in a somewhat abstract way. So when we talk about it in the abstract way, we make some assumptions about the makeup of the projects that are in a bonding bill and give you some guidance and measures about what debt service would be. When we have the governor's recommendations with very particular projects included, we do a debt We calculate the debt service on the cash flow of those particular projects. So sometimes you might see some wide swings in what somebody says, well, you know, how much would debt service be on a Bonney bill of this size? If it's in the abstract and it's kind of what we use as kind of average composition of projects and average cash flows, might be very different than what when we're looking at a very specific proposal for projects where we know the cash flows. And so just with that as background, and Mr. Salson can answer the specific questions about debt service.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Anderson. Welcome, Mr. Salson. The floor is yours.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Peter Salson from the Department of Finance, and I am going to be working off this presentation, which I believe the page handed out to everybody. And I would like to be interrupted, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be interrupted with questions as we go along. That has worked in the past. I don't answer the specific question of dollars of debt service. I don't have that in here, but I brought along as much reference material as I could, anticipating questions. So even if it's not in the document, I may have the information with me, and if not, we'll get it for you.
I understand that people want to believe that that's an easily assumed answer, that if we were to assume GO bonds of X, what would the debt service be? And I'm sure you'll explain to us it's a little more complicated than just getting out the Ouija board.
Mr. Chairman, so it is more complicated. The presentation after the cover page, there's the cover from the official bond statement, from the bond sold by the state of Minnesota and the Commissioner of Finance, dated at the top July 22, 2003. The bond's actually dated August 1, 2003. And on that date, the state sold $460 million of state general obligation bonds. Middle of the page, you see a table. You see the years and the dollar amounts of maturities and the interest rates on all the bonds through 2023. If you look right under that, you'll see that I just want to point out the makeup of the bond sale. The bonds comprise $296,645,000 of general obligation state various purpose bonds. Those bonds are bonds that finance the projects that are approved in this capital budget process by the Capital Investment Committee and by the legislature. $142,500,000 general obligation state trunk highway bonds, and those are for the recent authorization by the legislature of trunk highway bonds. And $20,855,000 general obligation state refunding bonds. There was one bond issue that we refinanced that at that time and included the dollars for the refinancing in this issue. Previous to that, we had a sale in June of 2003. I don't have the cover for that official statement. We sold about $400 million of bonds. We financed about $400 million of outstanding bonds and saved over $50 million in future debt service to the state by doing that refinancing. And we always look at refinancing opportunities and doing additional refinancing of outstanding bonds, particularly in this low interest rate environment.
We applaud you on your fine work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going to the page 2 debt management policy, the state has a debt management policy that's been in place since 1979. It's a policy of the executive branch of government, and it has three major goals. The first goal is to maintain and regain our AAA bond ratings. The state was AAA rated from three rating agencies, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch, through June of 2003, at which time Moody's made the decision to downgrade the state from AAA to AA1, half a step down to the AA rating. So now we are hoping to regain that again. In my opinion, it's not an easy thing to do, something that will take work over the next few years to try to get that AAA rating back and hold our AAA ratings from the other two rating agencies. We hope to minimize state borrowing costs. I think that's just sort of a given that you'd want to sell bonds, but minimize your borrowing costs and provide a reasonable financing capacity within a prudent debt limit. And that's going to go to the first goal or the first guideline that I'm going to talk about on page 3. Oops, actually, it's on page 4. But on page 3, I've listed some of our debt guidelines and what they are and where we are. And you're going to see this graphically as I move through the next few pages. So I think I'll just pass over them now and go to the graphs, because the graphs each tell the story in a better way. On page 4, is a graph that shows the general fund appropriation for debt service, which is not to exceed 3% of non-dedicated revenues. This is the state's first guideline, as our 3% guideline has been around now since the, for 20 years, it's a 3% number. Up until the mid-1990s was a constraint on the size of capital budgets. We would calculate how big the capital budget could be to get to the 3% level. It was a constraint. With the good times that rolled through the late 1990s, the 3% number became much higher at that time than people were perceiving capital budgets to be, and was no longer a constraint, and indeed has become a constraint again. And on my next page, I'm going to talk about the constraint that it has come again. You can see the number going back to 94-95, what the percentages are. This is based upon the November 2003 forecast. Page 5 talks about maximum debt capacity. Maximum debt capacity, where the 3% constraint actually goes to 3%. The Commissioner of Finance is required by statute to report to the legislature in November and February with the economic forecast on what maximum debt capacity is. We have been doing that for several years, and in recent years it's become a constraint again. From the November 2003 forecast, we calculated maximum capacity at $890 million each even-numbered legislative session into the future, and $100 million in each odd-numbered session. I want to point that out. So it's $890 million in '04 session, $890 million in 6 and 8 and so on out, and $100 million in all the odd-numbered years. And if you go out to the graph, you can see that we don't hit 3% until 2008-2009. I want to make sure that you're aware that it's not 3% every year. It's when we get to the 3% level in the future. This number has become important because the Senate, I believe, has in the past used this number as the size of their capital budget. I don't know if they're going to do that again, but for the Senate in the past couple of sessions, it has become a constraint on the size of what they would recommend. No questions, Mr. Chairman. I'll go to page 6.
Well, Mr. Sossin, if you could just perhaps you're going to cover this as we go forward, but you could just maybe give us a brief differentiation between what the $530 million of debt that was built into the November forecast versus what the $890 million debt capacity number is.
Mr. Chairman, you're looking for the dollar amount of debt service? Is
that what you're I'm just talking about if you could just explain to us what the differential is between those two numbers. I mean, I understand, I think I understand the differences, but just help me get a better clarification of what those two numbers represent.
Mr. Chairman, projecting the size of future capital budgets became controversial a few years ago. Under the Carlson administration, we had included, I believe it was $750 million for future capital budgets. When Governor Ventura came into office, he was talking about smaller capital budgets, and the number was lowered, I believe, to $400 million. It became controversial because forecasts are supposed to be current law. There is no current law on size of future capital budgets, and there was some people were unhappy that the number had gone down to $400 million. To get around that problem, the Department of Finance is now using rolling 10-year averages of capital budgets. So using averages of what's happened in the past to project in the future instead of someone picking a number which may become controversial. So the $530 million number is an average of past capital budgets in the even-numbered years. The $890 million says, okay, if we're going to use all of the debt service in this biennium or all the debt service in the future biennium at the 3% amount, how many dollars of bonds can we sell? As I'll indicate later in this presentation, the 3% number for 2004-2005 is $843 million. And 8 and 9, when we have the constraint, it's $979 million. So it says if we're going to spend all that money, that the 900 in 08, 09, when actually the constraint, as you can see on the graph on page 5, $980 million of debt service first has to pay the debt service on all the bonds that are currently outstanding, the principal and interest on the bonds outstanding for the next biennium. It's got to pay the debt service on new bonds sold for existing authorizations. There are bonds that have been authorized for projects that may be well underway that need additional financing. So that debt service number has to go to pay the debt service on new bonds that are sold, and whatever is left after the paying the bonds outstanding and new bonds sold for new authorizations is available for new bonds for new authorizations. Based upon our the debt management model, which we take forecasts of interest rates, we assume cash flows, we assume repayments of loans, make a whole lot of assumptions like that that go into the forecast, we can say that the money that's the additional, the balance money that's left over in 2008-2009 would provide an $890 million capital budget in that biennium, and then we have to move back to previous bienniums and move, put that number in. So it's a number that's calculated based upon debt service available and a whole lot of other variables that go into debt forecasting. Mr. Chairman, does that answer your question?
Everybody got that?
Oh.
I think we're partway there. Continue, Mr. Sawson.
You got to pay your bills.
On page 6 is a presentation of the second guideline that the general obligation debts not to exceed 2.5% of state personal income. I have been asked at different times whether ratings and the rating agencies are done on ratios. They calculate the ratios, and those states which have the best ratios get the highest ratings. Well, that's not the way rating agencies come up with their ratings, and I talk about it later, but the economics and state financial management are the two most important things. But if there's any ratio that the rating agencies use in comparing one state to another, it's the ratio of debt to personal income. And the state of Minnesota, among the about 40 states that issue general obligation bonds, and not all states do issue general obligation bonds, but among those who do, we're right in the middle somewhere. We're right somewhere in the low 20s among those states with the debt to personal income ratio. Page 7 is a graphic presentation of our repayment of our debt outstanding. We have about $3.2 billion in general obligation bonds outstanding that will be paid off over the next 20 years. We have a rapid repayment of the debt, our debt. A real characteristic of a AAA issuer is rapid repayment of our debt. We have a guideline that says 40% of the principal on our bonds should mature within 5 years, and 70% should mature within 10 years. And the average maturity on our bonds holds each year at about 7.5 years. This shows how the repayment of the debt outstanding in future years. We repay our debt when we put the principal payments on a bond sale. We start with level principal payments. So if we're going to do $200 million, pick an easy number, $200 million, and we're going to sell the bonds over 20 years, and 20 years is the maximum that the Constitution allows. 20 and the $200 million would mean we pay $10 million a year. So we'd start out with $10 million a year. And we make adjustments to that for certain reasons, but starting out at $10 million per year, and if you do that over time, this is the graph that comes out. This graph, the 40-70 ratio, 40% in 5 years, 70% in 10 years, there was no magic about it. It wasn't something that the rating agencies are looking at. It's just the way things worked out over time as the state sold its bonds and had this rapid repayment of debt. And we picked it up as a guideline probably about 20 years ago.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sousen, the bonds that are given out are low-interest loans or bonds, loans to entities throughout the state, basically counties or cities or things like that for whatever project. Do we ever have a entity that cannot come up with the money to pay back to the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, not that I'm aware of. When the city of Cambridge had their problems 5-6 years ago, there was a question whether they'd be able to repay the Public Facilities Authority, and I think the Public Facilities Authority, who has sells revenue bonds and makes loans, the Public Facilities Authority worked out an agreement to restructure the repayments by the city of Cambridge to help them through their their troubled times. But I'm, off the top of my head, I can't remember any other governmental entity who hasn't repaid the state.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hausman?
The issue we had before us last year, wasn't there, when was it Worthington? I thought that would have
Prairie been Prairie Land. Mr. Sausen, you want to comment on Prairie Land Expo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, Prairie Land Expo was a project in Worthington, Minnesota, a tourist attraction on I-90 in Worthington. The city of Worthington got $5.5 million of state general obligation bond proceeds and several grants, added a couple million dollars of local money, made this tourist attraction. Opened it up in September. I don't remember what year they opened it up in September one year, and 11 months later they closed it down because their attendance was much, much less than they had projected. Under the state grant agreements, it was actually owned and operated by the Southwest Regional Development Commission, and if the Southwest Regional Development Commission failed to operate it as a tourist attraction, the Commissioner of Administration who made the grants could put Southwest Regional Development Commission in default and seek repayment of the grants that were made to them. Commissioner of Administration never did that. The people in Worthington area made the determination that they would never reopen Prairie Expo, and in the summer of 2003 started working with the Commissioner of Finance seeking to find a means of negotiating means of how much be repaid. In order to sell the facility, they need the approval of it. Under statute, need the approval of the Commissioner of Finance. So the Commissioner of Finance had leverage in this negotiations. Negotiations have continued. The facility is just a little bit away, just getting all the legal documents in place of closing the facility. The city of Worthington, Nobles County, the school district, Worthington School District, the Southwest Regional Development Commission, will in all pay back the state about $1.8 million over the next 30 years. Most of it will come in the, about 600,000 of it will come in the form of the property tax payments on the facility. The facility is going to be sold to a private entity, Prairie Ventures. Prairie Ventures will be paying property taxes on the facility, and the property taxes that would otherwise go to the city, county, and school district instead are going to be sent to the state and partial repayment of this loan, and then there's some other sources of money also being.
So Mr. Chair, my reason for asking it now is that doesn't qualify then as in your answer to that question, you only listed Cambridge. So technically, the Worthington project doesn't fall under the same category as.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, that's correct. I would not put it in the same category.
You said partially. Repay, and so I didn't know if that was
Mr. Chairman, partial repayment. I took Representative Anderson's question to say that somebody owed us money on a loan. We're supposed to make an annual or semi-annual or monthly payment and failed to do it. In the case of Prairie Expo, they never legally owed us the money back because the Commissioner Administration never put them in default, but if the Commissioner had done it, they would have been liable for the $5.5 million all at one time.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want the rest of the story. So what will Prairie Expo become?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, Prairie Ventures is a company currently located in Worthington. The owners of it formerly owned another company, agricultural medicine-related company, that they sold to a private entity 7 years ago. Their non-compete clauses expired. They're competing again. People out there are excited about Prairie Ventures. I surely don't know what they do is so far from what I do that I can't explain it to you, except I was out there in October and went through their lab, and they had scientists working on things, and they showed me DNA, printouts of DNA of animals, and that's about as far as I can tell you what they do, but it's pretty interesting stuff.
While we're on the topic of Prairie Land Expo, Mr. Sausen, can you give us some indication as to when you think this deal might be inked?
Mr. Chairman, the deal will be inked hopefully in February. The agreement is in place. All the parties have signed the agreement. The it deals with the land and the building and recording it with the county and getting that recording done and getting then all the paperwork that we need here at the state back to us so that we can put all the documents in place and close the deal. The Commissioner of Finance then will sign off on the approval of the sale of the property.
And Mr. Sussin, can you give us just a little insight into why the commissioner would accept a an agreement? You said the total state bond was how much?
Mr. Chairman, it's $5.5 million.
$5.5 million, and we're going to get back $1.8 million over 30 years. Why? Can you give us some insight as to why the commissioner would take that agreement as to versus forcing them into forcing them into bankruptcy or whatever the commissioner would do?
Mr. Chairman, Department of Finance worked with the Commissioner Administration on this project. And if the Commissioner Administration would have put Prairie Expo, Southwest Regional Development Commission, into default, they would have owed the state $5.5 million. They don't have $5.5 million; it's not there. In putting together the workout, the $1.8 million, we were looking for every dollar out there that we could get from the folks, all the property taxes, the sale of the land, the value of the sale of the land from Southwest Regional Development Commission to Prairie Ventures. That money will come to the state. We didn't know where there's any other money out there other than to take money from the City-County School District and the Southwest Regional Development Commission that they use for their current operations, and I think the commissioner did not want to cut those entities any more than they didn't want to be cut, and the commissioner was not willing to do that. Mr. Chairman, I don't think that the city, the county, and the school district would not have been affected by the default. It would have been the Southwest Regional Development Commission. I think because all the parties out there jointly came to the legislature seeking this money, the city, the county, and the school district were willing to join in the settlement and give money that they would otherwise get to the state. But if the default situation, their money would not have been available unless they voluntarily decided to do it.
I thought, Mr. Sussin, what the Southwest Regional Development... wasn't their authority backed up by property taxes, or was that a joint?
Mr. Chairman, two or three legislative sessions ago, the legislature authorized the Southwest Regional Development Commission to sell a general obligation bond from them as the issuer to be repaid by property taxes of all the counties that are within their area, and the proceeds of that bond issue were used to pay back the cost of the Prairie Expo.
So while general obligation bonds of the state are backed up by the potential statewide property tax, under this local authority, there was no jurisdiction for them to repay any of the bonds if they were in default by a property tax.
Mr. Chairman, the bond issue that they sold to pay back their costs is secured by a property tax pledge, a general obligation pledge, of the counties in their area. I believe there are 7 counties, so that they will be levying on those property in those counties to pay costs related to Prairie Expo. Okay.
Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sussin, if you could give us I think it begs the question, what happens if someone does default, and what are the consequences for the state in that situation? Obviously, in the case of Prairie Expo, a lot of work has been done here to collect every dollar possible, as you put it. What happens if someone defaults? What are the implications for the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelleher, this is the first known example of default. If there are other defaults, why did it happen? I think that Prairie Expo was a project that was never going to be a success, that they assumed that all these people traveling on I-90 would stop and look at the exhibit. They didn't. Having traveled out there the summer before last, it seems like every major exit has their tourist attraction that would be in competition with them. other projects, I think we have to just, what happened? Is there a possibility it could be worked out? And it's too general to give you specifics, I think.
Mr. Chairman, my question isn't what happened. It's what happens to the state when a project defaults. I mean, and we don't have a lot of examples of this, but I suspect there are other examples around the country where this has happened. Is this a credit rating issue? Is this, you know, the statewide property tax issue? What things can happen in that situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Keller, the residents of the state of Minnesota will end up paying the debt service on the bonds for Prairie Expo that we intended to pay, but we're not getting the value. The value was a tourist attraction for the economic effects in southwest region of Minnesota. So we sold the bonds. We didn't get what we expected to get from them in the attraction, and they didn't get it either. It's not a rating issue, this small amount of money. To me, it's a large amount of money, but to the rating agencies, when we have $3.2 billion of debt outstanding, $5.5 million is not an issue. We've not even made them aware of it, and they wouldn't be interested in it if we made them aware of it.
Justin, as long as we're talking about projects that either were on the border or what's the current status of the Duluth Aquarium?
Mr. Chairman, the last information I have is their attendance in the summer 2003 was down, but they entered into a contract prior to the season with the people from Ripley's, believe it or not, to operate the facility. And it's my understanding that the Ripley's people were able to operate it so that the losses that were incurred in previous years were not incurred, that the performance, the financial performance of the facility, the aquarium, were much better. And it's my understanding now that the Ripley's people want to enter into a long-term agreement to manage that facility, although we in the Department of Finance have not seen any formal paperwork on that yet. Talking to the people in Duluth, that's what they have told me.
But any long-term agreement entered into by the city would need to have the approval of the Department of Finance?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The Commissioner of Finance is required to approve all use agreements between the local government and a non-local government, in this case, the Ripley's people, for it to be approved.
Thank you. If there are no other questions, let's proceed then.
Okay, I'm on page 8. There's another ratio, and this is a guideline that says state agency debt is not to exceed 3.5% of state personal income. We don't project this out in the future. We aren't always aware what the state agencies are doing. This is what state agency revenue bond. We have been well within this 3.5% guideline for years. Page 9 is a guideline that says the total amount of GO debt, general obligation debt, moral obligation debt, state bond guarantees, equipment capital leases, and real estate leases is not to exceed 5% of state personal income. This guideline was implemented in 1994, right after the Northwest Airlines deal was done here at the legislature. For those of you who may have been here at the time, it was highly contested discussions. And the state provided guarantees, state bond guarantees, for the Northwest Airlines project through Duluth, the Duluth Economic Development Authority. The question was asked at the time, will the state be doing a lot of these guarantees? And thinking in the Department of Finance was, let's come up with a guideline that sort of limits how much we can have in guarantees and other things that are shown on this page. It was implemented in 1994. It's all these guarantees to state personal income again as the denominator. You can see in the first year, 1994, we were at 4.37%, putting ourselves somewhat close to the 5% limit. But with the good times and the growth of personal income in the 90s, this ratio has now gone down to 2.03%.
So it was on June 30th, 2003.
Now that you bring up another topic, Mr. Sawson, how are we doing on the Northwest Airlines debt repayment?
Mr. Chairman, the Northwest Airlines transaction, the state sold about $47 million in bonds in 1995. There's currently outstanding, I believe, just under $39 million of the $47 million originally issued. Just over half the bonds are paid by lease payments to Northwest, and they have made all their payments. The other little less than half the payments are made by the city of Duluth, and all those payments have been made. So all the payments have been made since the bonds were issued.
And what's the term on those?
Mr. Chairman, the term on the bonds that were issued in 1995, there are 20-year maturity on the bonds, 2015, but the deal was structured as a 30-year lease, and the assumption was that sometime prior to 2015, when the bonds mature, the current bonds mature, that additional bonds would be issued and extend the final maturity to 2025 for the end of the 30-year period. That has not been done yet. As far as the Duluth Maintenance Facility, the Commissioner of Finance, there are public policy covenants related to the lease between the Duluth Economic Development Authority and Northwest. It required Northwest to have 350 jobs in the facility beginning maybe about 1998 or so. Northwest Airlines has been in compliance with the number of jobs in Duluth until December 31st, 2003. We measure it once a year on December 31st. And they were below. They were somewhere in the 200s on December 31st, 2003.
So what happens then, Mr. Sousa?
Mr. Chairman, there are public policy covenants, and there are remedies to the public policy covenants. Should they be in default, the Commissioner of Finance has the authority to move on the remedies. The first remedy would be that the MAC debt that was sold in 1991 as part of these overall agreements. MAC originally sold $270 million of their bonds. The bonds were refinanced, and I think the refinancing amount was about $285 million. That Northwest would have to, the remedy is Northwest would have to accelerate the repayment of the MAC bonds. The Commissioner of Finance has not yet made a determination on what she will be doing with this situation.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Salzman. I believe back in the 80s, before I was here, there was a chopstick factory that was up in northern Minnesota. Was that like on a bonding situation, too? And what about Iron World? Was that a bonding project also?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I believe both of those were revenue bonds issued by the IRRB. They were not state bonds. They were not general obligation bonds. They were revenue bonds.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Sousin, on page 9, the total amount of general obligation debt, state bond guarantees, etc., IRRB included in this their debt, or is this just GO, no revenue?
The bond, Mr. Chairman, the bonds that were issued would be bonds that are not a liability of the IRRB. They're industrial revenue bonds, and the liability is with the company, the chopsticks factory or others. They're not a liability to them. So if they're not a liability to the governmental entity, they would not be included in our account.
So they're not, okay, understand, revenue bonds, not a liability of the state.
But, Mr. Chairman, there are other revenue bonds that are a liability, the Public Facility Authority bonds that are issued. They are bonds of the Public Facilities Authority, and we do include those. bonds of the University of Minnesota, we do include those. So we do include them when there is a liability on the financial statements of the issuer, where it would be bonds payable on their balance sheet.
Well, to that point, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Novlock.
Mr. Sousin, how do you distinguish that? I mean, if this 5% figure includes moral obligation debt, I guess how are we distinguishing between what we're morally obligated to pay and what I guess we're not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Novlock, within the bonding industry, moral obligation bonds are an actual type of bond. It's not what we as a group or the legislature thinks as a group are morally obligated to pay. There is a bond called a moral obligation bond, currently issued in the state of Minnesota by the Housing Finance Agency. Until maybe 10 years ago, also issued by the Public Facilities Authority, they no longer do it. A moral obligation bond says that the issuer says that if there is a potential default or a known default on the bond issue, then the governor or mayor, if it's a local government, will stick with the state. The governor will request that the legislature appropriate an amount of money to make up the amount of the default so that the executive officer, the governor, takes affirmative action to request the legislature to appropriate money. In the marketplace, You know, that's the legal side of it. The legislature has no moral, no legal commitment to appropriate the money. They can say, we're not going to appropriate. Within the bond markets itself, bond traders believe that a moral obligation bond is the same as a general obligation bond, and they fully expect the legislative body to appropriate the amount of the default. But there's no legal requirement that that be done. So we have noted those as a separate sort of revenue bond in this calculation.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sals, maybe let me approach this a different way. What bonds are there that are issued or obligations that are issued by state agencies that are not included in this chart?
Mr. Chairman, if I just may have a second, I have a listing of what is included, if I can.
That might be easier, Representative. I'd like to figure what's in versus what's
whichever way works, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, I just have a lot of different papers here.
Sure. No, I understand.
It's not showing up. I think I'm going to be helped out. This is Sue Garola, who's my assistant and does all the heavy lifting for us. Thank you, Sue.
She's ready on the spot.
The revenue bonds that we include are the Housing Finance Agency, the Higher Education Facilities Authority that sells revenue bonds for the private colleges in the state, Metropolitan Council, both general obligation and revenue, the Higher Education Servicing Office that sells student loan bonds, the Public Facilities Authority, University of Minnesota, both revenue and GO. We did include the Cambridge Judgment Bonds that the Commissioner of Finance sold about 1995. They are all paid off. They're no longer here. We do, when it's a primary government bond, when it's a bond where there's a liability of the IRRRB, and note here says Giant Ridge, we do include that. We include the pension revenue bonds that were sold to finance the pension building in Empire Park, and we include the Armory Building Commission bonds.
So then, to that point, Mr. Chair, Mr. Sossin, now that we've heard that list, are there any types that come to mind that are not on it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, I can't think of any that I think should be on it.
Okay, so I mean, you said though that revenue bonds from the IRRRB aren't in this.
The revenue, Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, when there are not a liability of the IRRRB and there are industrial revenue bond that's payable by the manufacturing company, the chopstick factory example that was given, there was no liability on the part of the IRRRB. There are industrial revenue bonds that are issued by the state, the Ag and Economic Development Board, that is indeed issues industrial revenue bonds for small manufacturing projects. We do not include them because the Ag Board is not liable for the repayment of the bonds.
Okay.
Mr. Sossin, then I see on the list you also include real estate leases. This would be inclusive of the state leases for the new human services building and the new Ag health office buildings.
Mr. Chairman, they were included in the calculations you see here is as of June 30th, 2003. So at that time, $50 million were outstanding of the Port Authority bonds for those buildings. There are now about $200 million in bonds outstanding for those buildings. And then we do the calculation on June 30th, 2004, the full $200 million will be included.
So we can anticipate that this number will likely grow?
Chairman, I anticipate the number will likely grow.
Mr. Sossin, is the information about what is in this calculation, is that online or is that something we'd have to request from you?
Mr. Chairman, you can request it from us and we will get it to you and we'll...
I would appreciate seeing it then, members, if anyone else would like to see it.
It's a spreadsheet like this and we can email it, attach it to an email and get it to your staff and...
Okay.
That's okay.
We appreciate seeing it. So,
Mr. Chair, one more question to this page.
Certainly, Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Sossin, if the twins bonds that had been proposed back in the twins bill we passed a couple years had been sold, I assume they would have been in this number too, or if they were to still be sold. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, yes.
Okay.
No further questions on page 9. Let's continue.
Mr. Chairman, one of the favorite things that we do here in the legislature is our cancellation report.
Well, I'm sorry, Representative House.
Could I just follow up on that answer? Is that because of the way they were proposed to be restructured, or is there a difference between one corporation and another?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, I believe that the bonds that passed in the 2002 bill would have been sold, they would have been sold as revenue bonds of the state of Minnesota, and they would have appeared on our financial statements as a bonds payable liability, and under that, so that the state would have had requirement to pay back the bonds from money that came into the debt service fund. So I think that there's a liability of the state and would have been included in this ratio.
And I guess the further question, though, would be if the chopstick factory, which is how you refer to it, is responsible for that obligation, why would that be different from another private company?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, all the funds would have been kept within the state treasury. The bond proceeds fund would have been in the state treasury. The debt service fund would have been in the state treasury. The state would have had a responsibility for those bonds. In the example of an industrial revenue bond with the Chapsticks factory, the bond proceeds are not held in the state treasury. Their debt service fund is not held in the state treasury. They're held with maybe a trustee representing the manufacturing company that got the bond proceeds for their facility.
I think that just the differentials here would be the type of bond, and obviously when an industrial revenue bond is sold, you want to say the interest rate that's paid on that is going to be much higher because it's a much higher risk than would either a state revenue bond, let alone a state GO bond. Am I correct, Mr. Sausen?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. And using the terms from the business, it's called a conduit bond. And in a conduit bond, it's assumed that the governmental entity puts their name on the bonds but has no other responsibility for the bond issue, nor they have tax-exempt financing. You have to have a state or local government be the issuer. Their name has to go on the bonds and all the bond documents. So that's why the local state or local governments are involved.
Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sausen, I don't know if I missed something here on page 9 and then also on page 6. It relates to a percentage of state personal income. What's that basis, the state personal income?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tingelstad, the state personal income is an economic measure of wealth within the state in this case, and it's the total amount of personal income that people have within the state.
So is it based, Mr. Chair, to follow up, based on how much is collected for state income taxes, and then you figure out what people's gross income is for the year? Is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tingelstad, I'm not really involved in figuring it out, but I assume the economists who are involved in it use income tax figures and other economic information to estimate what personal income was, and then we project it forward in some of these graphs just using a percentage growth rate that's applied to us by our economic forecaster.
Thank you.
Mr. Sausen, the information come from the state economist. Where does that number come from?
Mr. Chairman, we get it from my staff gets it from the state economist. I think it's public information that's put out by the Federal Reserve or someone, but it's a known number that they provide to us.
Okay. Let's continue then on page 10.
Page 10 is the cancellation report. As I said, one of the favorite things we do here, because the cancellation report, Minnesota Statute 16A642 requires the Commissioner of Finance to report to the legislature now on January 1, it previously was February 1 of each odd-numbered year, on all projects where there are project dollars that are not committed, either capital projects or general fund projects. Those list of projects is presented to the legislature. They are automatically canceled on July 1 of the same year unless the legislature takes affirmative action to reappropriate the money for the project, so that we have projects that are complete. There may be a few thousand dollars left. There's no legal commitment behind it. Those projects are presented. There's other projects that have never started. There's never, a dollar has not been spent. None of it's committed. and we also present that. Very few in between, or the project wouldn't be half done because the balance of the funds would be committed through a legal contract to build the project. So we've been doing this. We started with this back probably about 1990. Representative Knobloch, when he was chair of this committee, made some good suggestions and changes that we incorporated into it, and we will report again on January 1st of 2005.
Mr. Austin, what you mentioned that we have approximately $3.2 billion in outstanding debt. What is the approximate amount of bonds that have been authorized but not issued?
Mr. Chairman, when I find the page, I'll take you to the page in the presentation. If you go to page 17. There's a table that shows general obligation bonds authorized, issued, and unissued. On the far right column is the remaining authorizations. The bottom number is $1,376,000,000. Mr. Chairman, that leads me to my next topic related to the cancellation report and your question. Thank you for setting me up so wonderfully on this.
Okay.
Is that when the governor's capital budget bill is presented in the legislature, there's going to be an Article 2 this year recommending the cancellation of bond authorizations. The cancellation report that I just discussed cancels bond appropriations for projects. There are also bond authorizations that need to be canceled. When a bonding bill is built, the legislature authorizes bonds to be sold, and those bond proceeds then are used to fund the appropriations in the capital budget. So if I just can pick a number, if the capital bonding bill is $500 million, the legislature authorizes $500 million of bonds to be sold. They'll also appropriate $500 million of the bonding for projects. When those projects get wound down, the cancellation report time comes. The cancellation report only talks about the appropriation side. But in so we have bond authorization, $1.3 billion that you just looked at. We're going to report in the governor's Article 2 of the governor's capital budget, and we'll get this information to you otherwise also if you don't see it. There's going to be about $374 million of recommended cancellation of bond authorizations. The majority of it is from the 2002 bonding bill when Governor Ventura vetoed about $353 million of bond appropriations for projects. The governor can veto the appropriations. The governor cannot veto the bond authorizations. There's a couple other small veto amounts from previous bonding bills before 2002, and then there's a whole lot of smaller stuff from old bonding authorizations going back to 1983.
And, Mr. Sussman, why haven't they previously been canceled?
Mr. Chairman, some of them had still had activity going on. In December, we made the decision that it was time to clean up the books, get all these bonding authorizations on a list, present it to the legislature, and get them canceled. We made an effort of where there are some bonding appropriations from these old things where there may be a few thousand dollars left that is encumbered in the accounting system. We encourage state agencies to unencumber that money and hopefully encumber other money in a newer bonding bill of the same type of project. Can't do that with the building, obviously, but some of the DNR stuff and some of the Bowser stuff, you can do that. We strongly encourage them to do that. In many cases, they did it so that the old bonding appropriations went down to zero so that we had then the ability to recommend canceling the authorizations that corresponded to the appropriations. So it will take all 83 to 93. The books are now clean. There's no money left to be spent. Because we have work to clean up the books, and there will be cancellation in all those years, plus some other years newer than 93.
That's provided the legislature acts.
Mr. Chairman, you are correct. I'm talking about the recommendation from the executive branch to the legislature.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Salzman, on page 17, it shows about midway down or almost two-thirds of the way down. It shows a transportation law authorizing 1998 authorization of $4 million or looks like 4,000. And then it says remaining authorization 00.
All the other ones have a remaining authorization. Just an explanation as to why the 00 is in that one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, we take this table from our bond official statement that I showed the cover on in the first page of this presentation, and within there, we always show the first time it goes to zero. We leave it in that document. The Department of Transportation spent the last of the $4 million sometime in calendar year 2003, so that all the bonds have been sold, all the appropriations have been spent. There's nothing left, and this is one where there's no need to cancel because all the bonding authorization has been sold. It's timing, just when the bond proceeds were spent and when the bonds were sold.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
I don't know if we are on page 17 and whether I
can
ask another
ask question, a
question about
on
that
page
one.
17.
Because there are so many transportation projects on here, I wonder if any of them are caught up in the same way that Ramsey County got caught up with the transportation commissioner, the previous commissioner, not the current, where the commissioner made some decisions about how he was going to use some of that flexible funding. In his mind, it was eventually going to Ramsey County, and maybe no one from your department ever told the commissioner that Ramsey County that Ramsey County would lose the money because of some internal decisions that the transportation commissioner was making. I wonder if we have any of those kinds of things built into, because we have so many transportation projects on this list, that some county is going to be surprised.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, these transportation bonding authorizations are for the most part bridge bonds. I don't know the internal process of the Department of Transportation in allocating the dollars, but the amounts are encumbered, meaning that there's a contract behind these amounts, so that there somewhere is a bridge waiting to be built or rebuilt with the proceeds of these bond sales. And as long as the money is encumbered, they will not appear in the cancellation report. Encumbered means there's a contract behind it.
All right, back to page 11.
Mr. Chairman, can I change the, just do something a little different?
Certainly, certainly.
One of the things in these presentations that people always like are my presentation of old bonds. I've done this, people who have been on the committee before have seen these, but I can't resist the urge to do it again. I looked at my watch, we're about halfway through the 2 hours here, so I think it's now timely to do this. I'll have the page when the page can pass this around. This is a bearer bond that the state would have issued. This is a sample of it from 1971. And over here is a $5,000 bond. It's a bearer bond because there's no names on it anywhere. The bearer of the bond owns the bond. And if you were an investor and you bought $10,000 worth of state bonds, you would have gotten two of these. You bought $100,000, you probably would have gotten 20 of them. On this side are the coupons that you used to have to clip. And if you start at the bottom, you have a coupon to clip every 6 months. I'll just leave it that way. You can look at the dates on them. And every 6 months, you would have clipped a coupon, gotten $125, taken it to your bank, and the bank would have given you the $125. And when the bond matured, you would have taken this, and the bank would have given you $5,000, or taken two of them and gotten $10,000. The state issued bonds in this form up until the early 1980s, when the federal government said the state and local governments couldn't issue them in this form anymore. They had two principal reasons for doing that. One was the estate tax that people who had bonds put them in a safety deposit box. They're bearer bonds. There's no record of them. And they passed from generation to generation without anybody knowing about them for the estate tax. Second reason was drug money. People who were involved in drugs needed somehow to invest their money. They didn't want to invest it where their name was on the account. They could buy bearer bonds where there was no name, and no one would know they held the bonds. So early 1980s, state and local governments couldn't do this anymore, and this is a cost-intensive way of doing business. And I'm very happy that the federal government said you can't do it this way anymore, because it's much cheaper the way we do it today. So maybe I can just hand it to the representative.
Now everyone understands where that term clipping coupons comes from.
Yes.
They didn't mean out of the newspaper.
Mr. Chairman, you are correct. They're right there.
I know it's signed by a resident of Litchfield.
Who was Commissioner of Finance at that time? from the time we stopped issuing the bonds in bearer form, they're issued in registered form. And this is a sample of a registered bond. There's no printing on it, but the computer would print out the name of the owner of the bond, the dollar amount. There are no coupons attached. Instead of getting coupons, the paying agent for the state would send a check to the owner of the bond. Since we knew who they were registered, we had their names, we had their addresses, and we knew how much they owned, we would send a check through our paying agent, which would be a bank, to them. And we issued bonds in this form until the late 1980s, and then we've now gone to issuing nothing but a handshake and thanking people for investing in our bonds. The state of Minnesota and all the other issuers and stocks, if you invest in stocks or bonds, you know that you don't get certificates anymore. The industry has moved to just keeping track on computers. There's a company in New York City called Depository Trust Company that's owned by the securities businesses that keep track of the ownership of all stocks and bonds, so you don't get coupons anymore. Nancy, if you can hand it around that way. So that's my little what state bonds look like in the past.
Thank you.
Now back to the bond
to the grind. The grind.
As I indicated earlier, the state gets ratings from three rating agencies: Moody's Investor Service, Standard & Poor's Corporation, and Fitch Rating Service. We were rated AAA, and I'm on page 11 now. We were rated AAA by all three rating agencies until Moody's downgraded the state in June of 2003 to AA1. The next page is just a definition of what Moody's considers a AAA bond. I'm not going to read it. I'm not going to spend any time on it, but I thought members may be interested in what their definition of a AAA bond is. Page 13 is the factors that go into ratings, what the rating agencies are looking at when they rate our bonds. And Mr. Chairman and members, I think that the rating is 99 to 95%. The first two factors on the page, financial management and economic vitality. Financial management isn't what we do in the Department of Finance. It's a big picture of financial management. It's budgets and tax recommendations by the governor that are financially responsible, actions by the legislature that are financially responsible. That's the big picture type of thing they're looking at. It's being, as I said earlier, when I talked about the debt repayment, we have a rapid repayment of our debt. That's a positive of the rating agencies. It's characteristic of the AAA issuer. And it's so that they're looking at that type of financial management, unlike selling bonds and having all the principal come due in the last year, so they pay interest for 19 years and pay principal in the last year. That would be pretty irresponsible financial management. So financial management is the first one. Economic vitality is the second one. This is the economics of the state. Tom Stinson, the state economist, would say that the state has an economy that pretty much mirrors the economy of the United States. So that when one sector falters, another sector may be strong. That's a positive. A diverse economy is a positive of the rating agencies. If you're the state of Louisiana, the state of Texas, where you may be dependent upon oil, and your state economy may move up and down as oil moves up and down, that is not a positive with the rating agencies.
Mr. Sasson, I've noticed recently that there have been couple of states, I believe Michigan was one, where their bond rating was reduced. My understanding is that at least the primary reason that was given was they had reduced their amount of budget reserve. Maybe you've, I'm sure you've looked at these and tracked these. Give us a little bit more information about how important the budget reserve is to that fiscal management piece of the puzzle.
Mr. Chairman, I think the budget reserve is very important to our financial management of the state. Many states have been downgraded by the rating agencies when they have used all of their budget reserves or even used it all and more and gone into a deficit position. Having that budget reserve there to cushion you when you have bad times is something the rating agencies want. In the case of the state of Minnesota, we used our budget reserve. We're now building it back up. Our ability and our and just the governor proposing and the legislature passing budgets that are rebuilding the budget reserves are a positive for us today in the eyes of the rating agencies.
Mr. Sasson, how rapidly do the bond houses respond to changes in state fiscal management?
I'm Mr. Chairman. The rating agencies, the people assigned to the state of Minnesota, monitor us on a continual basis. They used to get newspaper clippings. Now with the Internet, they are on the Internet, and they read news stories related to what's happening in the legislature and the rating agencies, and particularly Moody's, are interested in what happens to the legislature for state and local for local governments and school districts, who they also rate. So they're aware of what's going on and will be following the legislative process in 2004 as they did in 2003 and 2002. We in the Department of Finance make presentation to the rating agencies on an ongoing basis. We made one after the November forecast. We'll make another one after the February forecast. And we'll do it again after the end of session. And if any events occur between those times, we're on the phone telling them about those events so we can tell them. And they're big, big events. We can tell them they don't read about it by going to the newspapers on the Internet.
So is it safe to say that if the legislature decided, should there be a shortfall, or, I mean, we currently have a shortfall in the budget situation. If the legislature deemed that the easiest way to solve that budget reserve or that budget problem would be to take money out of our budget reserve, I presume you're saying that that would likely have a an impact on what the ratings, what the bond ratings might be.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to predict that if that's done, we'll be downgraded by any of the rating agencies. I can't make
that understand
prediction.
That, but that certainly is a factor.
They'll be looking at it, they'll be talking to us about it, and they'll be asking, why didn't you also cut the budget instead of just cutting the budget reserve?
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to follow up on that. Mr. Sasson, in terms of the Moody's downgrade last summer, it's a slight downgrade, but was there commentary with that, and what were some of the factors in that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelleher, yes, they always have a written write-up on the state. I think I'd prefer to get you the write-up and let you read it instead of me trying to paraphrase what they said in that write-up, because I don't think I can do justice to what they have said. We'll get that. Mr. Chairman, would you like copies to all your members?
I've already read it, so, but if Representative Kelleher, if anyone else would like it.
Mr. Chairman, we'll get a supply of them over to you, and you can hand them up to your committee.
Representative Kelleher, any follow-up? Okay. The Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Salzman, in determining the state bonds rating, you have four criteria here. Do you, as a person in the finance department, along with the state economists, do you get together and make recommendations with other of your types in other states to the bond houses and kind of as an advisory committee to help set criteria or to give information back and forth, and then that's the information given in? And if you do, are there some things that have been set that you don't necessarily agree with but you have to go along with as far as you're coming forward in your position, or are there things that that you think are good the way it is and that we should continue to adhere to, because that's what we have to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I'm not aware of any group of state officials, local officials that on an ongoing basis make any kind of recommendations or comments to the rating agencies on how they rate the bonds. I don't think the rating agencies are open to doing that. I don't think they want us to do that. And I think there's a risk involved in doing it also. None of that is done. The rating agencies are independent private companies, some of them are publicly traded companies, that set their own standards. They've been doing it for 100 years, and they will continue to do it on their own.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Salzman, how many states have all three ratings at AAA?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I believe it's now eight, and that's one of the things I forgot to include with all my stuff here, but I think there are eight states who currently have AAAs from all three rating agencies, and if you'd like, I can try to remember them. Otherwise, I will get the information to you.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no further questions, let's continue, Mr. Sussman.
Mr. Chairman, I was on page 13 talking about what determines a state bond rating. I'm talking about financial management and economic vitality. The other two factors are the state tax burden and the state debt burden. And the state of Minnesota has been a heavy tax state in the past. That that has not been a problem with the rating agencies since we were AAA, and I would just say that rating agencies are more open to governments that are willing to levy taxes because it's the taxes that pay the debt service on the general obligation bonds. The state debt burden, I said earlier, using the debt personal income factor, that we're somewhere in the middle of the 40 states that issue general obligation bonds. I just don't think this, the tax burden and the debt burden are all that important in determining the ratings. It's the financial management, big picture financial management, and the economy of the state.
So, just for edification of members, I think, Mr. Sawson, you want to just sort of go through the number one again, just so people are clear. We always seem to get some confusion when local entities are coming asking for general obligation bonds. So you want to clarify what number one means?
The financial management indicator, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm on page 14. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, moving to page 14, and this is from the Constitution, and this is what the Constitution allows general obligation bond proceeds to be used for. And the first check or the first bullet is the project for which the bonds are to be issued must be publicly owned. Must be owned by a state agency, must be owned by a political subdivision, a city, a county, a school district, or other political subdivision. It cannot be owned by a for-profit, private company, non-profit, or anybody that's not a state entity. The federal government can't. Indian tribes can't own it. They're not public entities. It's state agencies and political subdivisions that can own bond finance property. The second one, the project must be a capital expenditure. We do not sell our bond proceeds for operating expenses. About 1989 and 1990, this became an issue in trying to define what a capital expenditure was. Working with the Dorsey Law Firm and the Attorney General Office, the Dorsey Law Firm's estate bond counsel, we had letters that were written in both 1989 and clarified in 1990 as to what a capital expenditure is. Those letters have been widely, widely distributed. Mr. Merkins is sending out his information on the capital budget and the request process includes those letters to say this is what we can fund, that it's a capital project, capital expenditure. The third is it must have a public purpose. The project in the building must have a public purpose. There must be a public program with oversight by a public entity. It cannot be a for-profit company, a non-profit company, and they're running their own business that is not a program of a state agency, a program of a local government. The Constitution does not allow it. And the last bullet is the purpose for which the bonds are to be issued must be clearly set forth in the law. The Constitution requires that in the language for the appropriation, you have to be specific in that language. The language has to say that you're going to appropriate $10 million for a science facility at a Metro State or Normandale or whatever they call it, the University of Minnesota. You can't say that you're appropriating $10 million to the Chancellor of Minsky for building somewhere in the state because it's not specific. It has to be specific.
Mr. Sawson, just again, so committee members have a clear understanding, I know you've spent a great deal of time with two projects that were authorized in the 2003 special session, one being the Guthrie, the other one being the Children's Theater. Do you want to just, the Guthrie, the other one being the Children's Theater. Do you want to just give us a little insight as to what the outcome of those use agreements and the like?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the Guthrie Theater received $25 million. Actually, the City of Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Community Development Agency, in the language, received $25 million in state bond funds for the new Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. The site of the Guthrie Theater is owned by the Guthrie nonprofit and is being leased by the Guthrie to the City of Minneapolis for 50 years. In our legal work, the legal advisors we have say that a 50-year lease is equivalent to ownership. So that, in effect, the City of Minneapolis owns that site and will own the building, the theater that will be built there. The City of Minneapolis is leasing it back to the Guthrie for 20 years, not 50, but 20 years, to run a public program, a theater program of the City of Minneapolis within that facility. and the Guthrie has to get approval from the city of Minneapolis on an annual basis for the operations of that facility. So, in effect, there is oversight. The building is owned by the city. There's a public program, which is theaters, and there's oversight by the city, Minneapolis City Council. For the Children's Theater is located to the Art Museum in South Minneapolis. That site was, it's complicated here, Mr. Chairman. The site was owned, was given to the city, and there's agreements with the Art Institute, but in effect, getting through those complications, the Hennepin County, who received, I believe, a $5 million bonding appropriation for the Children's Theater, Hennepin County, through a long-term lease, owns the site, is leasing it back to the Children's Theater for 20 years. So, in effect, the facility is owned by the Hennepin County with a public program of Children's Theater in there with oversight by the Hennepin County Board.
In one legislator's opinion, I think that the people who penned this article in the state constitution would be somewhat appalled at what the legislature does now with general obligation bonds, but that's just one legislator's opinion. But so, anyway, other questions? Representative Hausman.
What I don't see here is something that several of the last governors have made a big deal of, and that is that it must be of statewide significance. I don't see it in the Constitution, and I don't see it in the four tests to be met.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, that is not in the Constitution. It's a policy of past governors and past legislators when they've worked on the legislation to try to move projects to being projects of statewide or regional significance.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Knobloch.
But it is, Representative Hausman, it is in statute, just to be clear. And I don't know if you're going to talk about that, Mr. Salson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, I was not going to talk about that.
Okay.
But it was passed. There was a statutory change, I would say, maybe 4 years ago, that tried to come up with criteria for projects to determine if they were statewide or regional significance or local projects.
Any further questions, Representative Hausman?
Well, I hate to ask as an example something that's in the governor's budget, but because that's why I'm confused. In the governor's budget, he has the Colin Powell Youth Center in Minneapolis. So he must feel that doesn't break that state statute.
Mr. Merkins, you know, it's a good thing you're here. You can come up and try to field that question.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lee Merkins, Capital Budget Coordinator with the Department of Finance. First of all, on the statewide significance implication of the statute, I think the statute we're talking about is Minnesota Statute 16A.86, and that statute doesn't necessarily lead to conclusions about what projects should be funded. It really sets a mechanism for when the Department of Finance receives requests from local units of government, sets forth the parameters of how they should be evaluated. There's criteria that are specified in that statute. One of them says, you know, identify whether the project is of statewide, regional, or local significance. So when the Department of Finance receives requests from local units of government, we evaluate it against that criteria in law. And just to explain how we do that, we look at sort of the dispersion of benefit for the various projects. Does it primarily serve a local area, which would be a city or an adjacent city? If so, then we would suggest it would be a local project. Does it serve a bulk of the citizens served or the constituents served? Would it be in a county or multi-county area? Then it would be regional. And if it serves people from all around the state, we might consider it statewide significance. The difference between a community center versus a statewide arena, for example. So that's sort of the framework for how we evaluate the projects. The governor's recommendation on Colin Powell, I don't think that there was necessarily an assertion that that project has a spillover to residents all over the state of Minnesota. It's very specifically proposed for residents in that Phillips neighborhood that, that have high incidences of crime and poverty and domestic abuse and families that are under stress. I think the governor's not necessarily advertising it as something with statewide significance. I think the governor's recommendation was more of the spirit. That's a community that needs to be served by a project of that type. Although there are also implications on our criminal justice system that I think some analysis has been done by project proponents in that area to look at the amount of crime in that area and sort of the number of people that have been incarcerated and where they come from in the state of Minnesota. And the information, as I understand it, suggests that there's a fairly significant number of people from that area that have ended up in our criminal justice system. Governor's concerned about that.
But presumably, that Representative Knobloch, then that would not mean statute specifies it may not, but that, that is simply criteria for judging type of project. Otherwise, you and the governor have a different point of view about state law.
Well, I was just pulling out that statute because my recollection is just a little bit different, although I will say that, you know, when I was chairing the committee, I mean, there are as many different views of what a regional project is as there are members who have projects they want to be considered regional and want to considered funded. I mean, it's a moving definition. When we, it was originally my bill. When we had hearings on it, we debated about whether we should try to have some more specific criteria. It's got to serve at least 100,000 people or something like that, and we just rejected that as unworkable. But I think, you know, you can argue about whether this is a regional project or not, but I think that, you know, my interpretation of the criteria, and I have to look at the law again, was more that we really are going to look at only funding projects of regional or statewide significance in the bill.
Representative Hausman, follow up? Or
I could, but I won't.
Obviously, I think this is one of these statutes that open for interpretation. Yes, we'll get into interpretation later. Thank you, Mr. Merkins. Let's continue then, Ms. Shawson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm on page 15 then, and there are other constitutional provisions allowing the issuance of state general obligation bonds that are listed on 15. I think I'll go through them quickly and give you examples of where they have been used. And take questions if there are questions. The first one, repel invasion and suppress insurrection, I don't think in my lifetime that we have done that. The second one, borrow temporarily. The state borrowed temporarily, did short-term borrowing to pay our bills in the early 1980s. We've last done that in 1985. The budget crisis of the early 1980s, the state borrowed up to $850 million just to pay our bills because of the timing of revenues coming in and expenditures going out.
Mr. Sawson, to that point, I thought the Constitution gave us a prohibition on borrowing for operating expenses. It doesn't?
Mr. Chairman, this is borrowing. This is short-term borrowing. It has to be paid back at the end of a biennium. So at the end of any biennium, you cannot have any short-term borrowing outstanding. So it's all short-term in nature.
Okay.
The third one is refunding outstanding bonds of the state, which we have done, and I said earlier we have done it in calendar year 2003. Establish and maintain highways. We've issued trunk highway bonds recently. We've issued transportation bridge bonds for years and years and years. On trunk highway bonds, they're also discussed in Article 14 of the Constitution.
And for a point of clarification here, help us understand the difference between, or I guess there's some convoluted interpretation that we cannot use general obligation bonds for highway construction.
Mr. Chairman, you cannot use general fund supported general obligation bonds to make improvements to the trunk highway system. The Constitution does not allow it. We issue general obligation bonds supported by the trunk highway fund to make those improvements. But the lawyers have looked at this. We have letters from the Dorsey Law Firm as our bond counsel saying that they don't believe that we can issue general fund-supported general obligation bonds to make improvements on the trunk highway system.
So, members, that's a point that Certainly, I've encountered, and I'm sure that you may have encountered or will encounter, your a city, a county comes to you and says, we need a bridge replaced that's on the trunk highway system. And they say, well, you're on the capital investment committee. Please introduce a bill so that we can go replace Bridge X that's on the trunk highway system, or that we can make improvements. Bridges are probably the most common. And so you need to refer them to Mr. Sousen, or so there's a clarification that we cannot issue GO bonds in order to make improvements on the trunk highway system.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just clarify once again,
yes.
It's general fund supported.
General fund supported.
General obligation,
yes.
Bonds.
So we can issue trunk highway bonds to do that.
Which are also general obligation bonds and supported,
yes,
by the trunk highway fund.
Yes.
And Mr. Chairman, your observation is correct. As I look at bill introductions, I see numerous bill introductions the last few years for bridges on the trunk highway system funded with general fund supported general obligation bonds.
So if you're one of those authors, have an amendment ready when you get to the Transportation Committee.
Mr. Chairman, the next bullet is promote reforestation and prevent and abate forest fires, and the legislature has appropriated bond proceeds for reforestation over the last many years. The next bullet is construct, improve and operate airports and other air navigation facilities. The bond sold for the Northwest Airlines maintenance facility in part was allowed under this provision. The next bullet is to develop the state's agricultural resources by extending credit on real estate. The Rural Finance Authority, part of the Department of Agriculture, has issued bonds for beginning farmer programs under this provision in the Constitution. And the last one, improve and rehabilitate railroad right-of-way and other facilities, whether public or private. This has been used in the past. The Department of Transportation has had a rehab program for rail lines and communities. And if the North Star Corridor is funded with bond proceeds, this is the provision that would be used. What is not here, and what I should have included this time, is the Constitution limits the amount of debt outstanding for this provision to $200 million. So this is not an open-ended amount.
Okay. Representative Hausman?
He's answering the question when you finish the sentence.
Okay. Let's continue then.
Page 16 is historical bond authorizations going back to 1983. It shows the legislative year, the governor's recommendation. We have general fund-supported projects in the third column with a box on it. To the right is user finance-supported bonds. A user finance-supported bond would be a general obligation bond, just like the other bonds, but they would be supported by the one-third debt service payments by the University of Minnesota, by the Rural Finance Authority loans and the repayments on those loans, other loan programs in the state where there's money coming in to repay the bonds. They're included under user-supported bonds. The next column is the trunk highway bonds. You can see that no bonds were authorized between 1983 and the year 2000. Direct appropriations means it's cash dollars normally from the general fund. And then the last column is the total of all capital budgets.
Strauss, and I was, as I was looking back through some of these past appropriations, I noticed that I can't find here. There was a year. Let's see. There was one year when the legislature passed an inordinately large bonding bill in the odd numbered year. I don't see anyway. It's of no significance. Anyway, Representative Hausman.
I wonder if we could invite your observation about the wisdom of what we're doing under the column trunk highway supported bonds, because there's suddenly a dramatic shift and in terms of the size of that. And in this instance, because we're using trunk highway dollars, some would argue it's a deteriorating infrastructure, and the future will be paying interest on our filling our potholes today. And how does that fit, do you think, under a, what did they, what the financial management, or how they, the financial management of our state? How might somebody from the outside look at the shift away from the Trunk Highway Fund on an ongoing basis to pay our projects?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, within what the rating agencies look at, they're mainly interested in the general fund, although they will pay attention to the Trunk Highway Fund, but their main attention is to the general fund. As far as selling bonds to make improvements to the Trunk Highway system to pay it over 20 years, I think you go to school and you learn these kinds of things, they'll tell you in the textbooks that when you sell bonds and pay them over 20 years or longer in other jurisdictions, that the users of the facilities are paying for those facilities. So when highways are going to last 20 years, the people who drive on them over the next 20 years through the gas tax, which goes to fund the Trunk Highway Fund, will be paying for that road that was improved, although it may have been approved today or next year or whenever. So I think just philosophically, and it works.
I guess what I'm thinking of is, if you look ahead, though, it means part of that in the future will just go to interest. It won't be building roads.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, the Department of Transportation has been on a pay-as-you-go basis, so they were able to build roads as money was available. Now bonds are being sold. They're building more roads. And, yes, a portion of the money coming in the future will go to pay debt service on the bonds that were sold today to build improvements today, which would mean that there will be less the construction that they plan to do 10 years from now has been moved up and won't be done 10 years from now. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Salson, I found my question. 1987, there was a, you have a recollection of why there was a general obligation bonds of about approximately $470 million in the odd-numbered year?
Mr. Chairman, I think if you look at 1986, there was no capital budget in 1986, or a minor amount. 1986 was created, I think, of the $70 million in the column. Next column is most of that was for the Rural Finance Authority. And I don't, well, we had, there was capital budget reform in the early 1990s where the concept of doing a capital budget in an even-numbered year was really formally to be established. So prior to that, I don't, you know, the legislature talked about it, but there was no, as it is today, where the legislature says even numbered year, we're going to do capital budgets. That really wasn't in place in 1987.
Okay. Let's continue then if there are no further questions.
Page 17 we looked at previously. This is lists all bonding authorizations that are outstanding. And again, with what's going to be in the governor's capital budget, will be reduced by about $374 million should the legislature choose to do that. Page 18 is a listing of bonds outstanding on February 1st, 2004. At the bottom of the page, there are $3,224,000,000 of bonds outstanding. This table is set up. This is another table we take out of our official statement for our bond sales and modify it for this purpose. But heading at the top, type category one are our general fund supported projects. Category two are projects where there is a loan outstanding. There will be repayment on the bonds sold for those projects. Category 3 are trunk highway bonds. And Category 4 are sports and health club bonds, which were sold about 1989, along with cigarette tax bonds at that time. All the cigarette tax bonds have been paid back. The legislature at that time, the state was at the 3% guideline. The legislature wanted to bond more, so they created debt service payments from the sports and health club tax and the cigarette tax that were outside of the general fund didn't count in the 3%, and were able to have a bigger capital budget and sell more bonds because those two sources of revenue were outside of the 3% guideline. Since that, in 1991, when Governor Carlson came into office, he directed us to include those amounts within the 3%, and they are included within the 3% guideline yet.
Okay.
Page 19, I went through this much earlier, the three uses of the debt service appropriation. The debt service appropriation in the November forecast, I think, was $653 million. That was in the forecast. A little higher for the governor, about $3 million higher for the governor's capital budget in 2004 and 2005. But again, first use of that amount of money is to pay the debt service and the bonds already outstanding. The second is the new bonds issued for existing bonding authorizations where bonds have to be sold to continue funding projects that are underway. And third, allows for new bonds issued for new authorizations. So the $653 million, if you were to see that number, is just not for new bonds. It includes the existing bonds that are outstanding. Page 20, our bond payments. The state bonds are repaid over a 20-year period. Each year, the state is obligated to pay the investors interest on the bonds and pay a portion of the principal amount of the bonds. To make these payments, the state agrees to levy a tax to raise the money for the payments. The Constitution requires a statewide property tax to be levied to pay the debt service on the bonds. And until a couple of years ago when there was education reform, there was no statewide property tax because the legislature otherwise always appropriates debt service money from the general fund instead of having the statewide property tax. And the state has $3.2 billion outstanding. We just saw that a minute ago. Page 21, the last page, our bond sales. Bonds are sold to provide cash to pay the ongoing cost of capital projects. The next bullet is something I get a lot during the legislative session. Are bonds sold for a project? Have we sold bonds for a specific project? And I always have to respond, we don't sell bonds by project. We sell bonds by legislative authorization. So in our last bond sale in August of 2003, we sold bonds authorized by the legislature for the laws of 2003 and the laws of 2002 and 2001 in going back to fund the projects, but we don't specify money, bond proceeds, to go to a particular project. Any project authorized under the legislature in 2003 or 2002 can use those bond proceeds. To figure out how much the bond sale should be, we do a cash flow estimate. That's the third bullet. We ask agencies who have capital projects, how much do you expect to spend over the next period of time for them? August of 2003 bond sale, it was to the summer of 2004. How much of bond proceeds do you expect to spend? And then what we call size, to determine the dollar amount of bond to be sold based upon the estimates of the agencies. We sell bonds by competitive bid, with the winner buying all the bonds. We usually have three bidders. Bidders are usually New York Wall Street firms. And we like to say that we have gone from doing a paper bid process to electronic bidding. Our bidders now, and we sit at their trading desk and bid bonds through proprietary computer systems. We get the results over the internet. We also provide our documents electronically. We have official bond statements. Here's an official bond statement from August of 2003. We used to have to print two of these, one a preliminary, which has red along the sides. We no longer print that one. It's available only on the internet. We do print a few copies. We send printed copies to the rating agencies, and that's about it. We don't print it at a savings for each bond sale by not having to print it, and we tell people if they want it, they can look on the internet, and if they want to download it, they can download it through their printers. We do have to print this one. We are required to print this one, and the winning bidder has to provide it to each of the buyers of the bonds. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think I've completed my task. I've probably forgotten things that you want, but I hope we have answered some of the committee's questions today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sawson. We appreciate your due diligence. As I said before, certainly appreciate all the fine work you do in keeping us on the fiscally prudent path. And unless there are any other questions, we'll conclude this session. Thank you very much again. Meeting adjourned. Committee members, tomorrow we are going to hear from the cities of the first class, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, about their requests. And so come prepared to listen to their presentations. Thank you very much.